Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 47, being recorded on the 9th of October, 2014, with special guest Ryan Krakor. I'm Sujit Mello. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft in the app dev space, based out of New Jersey. And on Skype with me today, I have my esteemed colleague, Kale, and our special guest. Guys, please introduce yourselves.
Hey, this is Kale. I'm a consultant in the New York region as well, specialize in app dev and Azure projects.
Hey, I'm Ryan Krakor. I'm one of the program managers on the Azure Document DB team. So I am partly responsible for shipping cool services.
Excellent. And we're very, very fortunate to have Ryan on the show today. He's definitely one of the most vocal people we've seen internally on this DocumentDB product. And we hope to pick his brains a little bit on that today. He's got a very busy schedule, so we appreciate him taking the time to talk to us and our listeners. So, Ryan, just to get the ball rolling, I'd like to just ask you a very base question here. You know, What's the whole motivation behind this fascination with no SQL type databases? Why has that become so popular these days?
I think that's probably a good place as any to kind of kick things off. And yes, I mean NoSQL databases have been around for a number of years and they've been gaining traction, you know, as products mature and as you know, we kind of get used to this new world. But I think what's been driving them is we've fundamentally changed the way we build applications. You know, if I look at how we're building services today and how we're shipping services today, that is fundamentally different from how it was when I was a dev building box products, you know, 15, 17 years ago. Don't want to give my age away, but I'm not that old. But the idea is that, you know, previously we used to kind of spend all this time, we used to analyze products, we used to, you know, gather the requirements, we used to do these detailed kind of, you know, very comprehensive designs, and we used to build these data models, and then we'd build the application on top of the data model. And largely that data model was kind of like set in stone, and it's been signed off by your data architects and your enterprise architects and all of those kind of cool things. And you go into the cycle and you build a product and, you know, a year later you ship something and, you know, then you go into a new release and, you know, 3 years later you ship another release. You know, that used to be kind of a cadence for big, you know, applications. And if I look at Microsoft, that's how we used to build things like Visual Studio and Office and you know, SQL Server and all of those kinds of things. But that model has changed. You know, we've gone to much more agile, much more kind of, frequent delivery of applications where we ship something really quickly, we get that feedback from customers, we look at what features are working, what's not working, and we adjust and we change, you know, on the fly, and we ship a new version within weeks, you know, and that new model has been one of the drivers behind having a database that supports this flexible kind of notion that we work in. And doing these big, you know, models and having the application bound to this data model, you know, that slows that innovation down, and it kind of slows down that process because you have to go through the entire stack and you have to update your data model, and then you have to update your ORM layer, and then you have to update your application, and, you know, it becomes a very complex, very costly business to change, you know, something as trivial as what attributes you're storing for a particular record. You know, and that, I believe, is one of the big drivers behind NoSQL. One of the other drivers, I think, is also, you know, we as human beings and in the digital age and the connected age, the amount of data we're producing and consuming and storing is just phenomenal. I mean, you know, when I started out, the concept of a terabyte was just ridiculous. Now we're way beyond terabytes and we're speaking petabytes and beyond. And, you know, that's only accelerating and it's only getting, and it's only getting quicker. And we really do need the ability for databases to be specialized in doing certain things. And, you know, we now have relational databases that specialize in a certain kind of data store and data access. And we have graph databases that are very specialized. And we have document databases that are specialized. So it's no longer kind of, you know, one product to rule them all. You know, we've got these specialized products that are all doing very specialized things. And they all form part of my, you know, application or solution architecture. So there's a couple of different drivers. I mean, those are you know, two of them off the top of my head.
Yeah, Kale, you got to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, it's great, right? It brings a lot of good things to the table. So what would be the bad things? Like thinking about where does this not fit? Where does it still make sense to use relational database or something like that as opposed to a NoSQL database?
So, I mean, that is a great question. And, you know, a lot of people have said to me over the last month, well, this is brilliant. You know, does this replace SQL Server or does this replace, you know, MySQL or other relational databases? And I'm like, no, not at all. You know, they each of these databases, like I mentioned, have a very specific part in the ecosystem, I believe. You know, so relational databases by their very name are really, 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 really good at maintaining complex, deep, nested relationships that are like linked to each other. So you get this concept of, you know, being able to have foreign key constraints and you're able to get this idea of cascading updates and cascading deletes and, you know, all those kinds of things. Relational databases, that's what they're designed for. That's their bread and butter. And there is no other database, type of database that does that better than relational databases do. And when you want to kind of be able to do this transaction across multiple entities that are related to each other and these kind of joins, and that's what relational databases are really designed for. And there's business applications today that will still need relational databases, absolutely, without a doubt. And relational databases are not going anywhere. This is just a new type of database for things that we were potentially doing in a relational database that wasn't relational.
Right. So kind of a follow-on question to that then too would be, so if I'm using a relational database and, you know, one of the things you mentioned, like in the past, we did a lot of planning and, when we were building these enterprise applications, and one of the things we'd do is tune those queries that we're going to do. We were using stored procedures and we had our specific indexes in there that we needed to make our query as optimal as possible. So when we lay out the structure, I know I've heard in the past, and I'd like to hear about the NoSQL side, when we establish our database up there and we say, this is the way we're going to query our data out of there. And then 6 months later, that changes and we want to query it kind of a different way, or we want to get that data a different way. Will there be performance impact? And is it possible to do something like indexes with this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that's a very important point, is the fact that just because we're moving to a different kind of database doesn't mean all that good stuff that you do around kind of planning goes out the window. You know, I think all it means is that we're doing this more agile and we're doing this easier and we're more flexible. But absolutely, you still need to model your data. You still need to think about how do you, you know, model your data, whether it's a record in a SQL table, whether it's a node in a graph database, whether it's a document in a document database. You still need to think about how your data is structured, how it's going to be written, how it's going to be read, how records interact with each other. All that stuff you still need to think about and you still need to plan for it. So don't throw all the planning and the data modeling out of the window. Some of these NoSQL databases just make it easier and more flexible to kind of adjust and amend and add new properties or completely change the structure of a document. You know, instead of a document having, you know, 10 fields on it, it's now got, you know, 5 fields with some nested types, and, you know, so completely changing the structure of a document is really easy and it still fits within your whole data architecture and your whole plan. But the representation of that is now completely different. And I think that's where NoSQL databases really kind of help. Indexes, absolutely. Indexes are still the way for the database engines to find the record you're looking for really, really quickly. And in these NoSQL databases where you've got massive scale, you know, into the terabytes and petabytes, it becomes very important that the index engine knows and then, you know, exactly where to go find these records, so you don't end up doing massive, expensive, costly scans. So indexes are absolutely still important. And all of the NoSQL document databases that are out there, they all have a notion of index, whether it's a manual index or like DocumentDB has this notion of automatic indexing. They all have indexes, and you can kind of tune these and tweak these and set them up exactly like you want for your application, the same way you would do before.
Now, Ryan, you've used the word GraphDB a couple of times in the last few minutes. I think I have some idea what that means, but for the sake of our listeners, could you clarify what that is and how it is different from the other types of databases, please?
Sure. A graph database is a very specific kind of database to solve a very specific kind of problem. If you think of, let's say, an example like LinkedIn. LinkedIn, you're linked to Kale directly, and Kale's linked to me directly, and therefore you have like a second degree link between, you know, yourself and myself, because Kale's the immediate person in the middle. Now you can imagine that level going, you know, 6, 7, 8 levels kind of down.
Mm-hmm.
Graph databases are very, very good at finding these kinds of broken relationships type of thing, these deeply nested kind of relationships. If you also think about, you know, an Amazon.com where I buy this book and therefore, you know, I'm also interested in this book and Kale bought that book and I was interested in something else he bought. Therefore, I'm probably interested in something else that's related to that. So these kind of very complex graphs that you start building up, and social networks are a good example of those. Those are very, very, very good in a graph database. If you try to model that sort of kind of relationships and interconnections inside of a relational database, you're going to look like me pretty soon, which is bald and great, because it's an incredibly difficult job to do. Whereas in a graph database, it's dead simple, and they're designed to do that. However, if you try and model your documents and, you know, store them inside of a graph database and do things that would be better in a document database, you're going to pull your hair out in a graph database as well. And that's where I say, you know, you need to look at your data, how it's going to be used, how it's going to be written, how it's going to be read, and then decide to use the right tool for your need.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you. Now, you know, someone naive as myself might think, okay, you know, I know I'm used to dealing with tables in Azure, right? The Azure tables, they're something that we've grown to love since Azure first started. Give me an idea as to how is that sort of key value pair system different from a DocumentDB style system?
Cool. So key value pair is one of the categories of NoSQL databases. So NoSQL database categories have key value pair, graph databases, document databases, column store databases. Those are generally the categorizations that things fall under. There's probably a bunch of others that I've forgotten, but those are the general four categories. Now, key value pairs generally, as their name suggests, have some kind of a key that you key your records on, and then some kind of a value. And that value is either a primitive type like a string or a number, or it can be a complex type like an entire object graph, you know, that you take an object and you serialize it as a string and you store that as the value. Now, key value stores are really good at very, very, very quickly finding records by their key, which is the primary indexable, kind of searchable, queryable field. That's what they're very, very good at, storing vast amounts of data and being able to find it very quickly by the key and only the key. And that's why it's, you know, by its name is a key value kind of store. Now, documents databases, for instance, take a look at saying, well, we're not going to create just a single key for you to query on. We're going to take that, what you might have stored as the value, for instance. We're going to take that object and we're going to serialize it as a JSON document. And we're going to then index the paths of that JSON document to allow you to be able to query on any attribute within that document. So whereas a key value store, you generally kind of limited to that single key or a secondary key, we traverse the JSON document and allow you to kind of index and query on anything within that. And that's one of the fundamental differences, I believe, between the two.
Excellent. That makes it so clear. Thank you. Now, you know, and Kale, I'm sure you're wondering, like, when Microsoft had to build something like this, like, did they start from scratch, or did they use some of the existing open source projects out there, like we did for our caching system, where we used Redis, for example? What's the backstory over there?
I mean, it's a very good question, and it's one that's been asked a number of times, not only by external people, but by internal people too. You know, when we sit down and we decide to build a new product or build a new service, it's not something that we kind of choose to do lightly. You know, there needs to be a need, okay? And the first place we'd look to serve that need is what's already there. You know, do we have something within the organization? Because we always look internally first. Is there something in the org that's gonna serve this need? If there is not, then, you know, can we look externally and take one of these open source projects and potentially contribute back to them or fork them off and, you know, create our own fork like we did with Hortonworks and Hadoop, with the HD Insight service, mm-hmm. And the Redis cache, for instance. And those were viable options. And when we started out with this project, we sat out and we looked, but before we started looking for the actual technology to do this, we had a set of key goals and key deliverables that we needed to hit, because that's what was being asked of us by various organizations within the company. You know, these are the key things that we need to hit. And we couldn't find an engine or a product at the time that served every one of those needs. And by the time we'd kind of ripped out a database's indexing technology to replace it with a different index technology, and by the time we've, you know, kind of made all the adjustments we needed to deliver this thing as a multi-tenanted scaled out service, and by the time we changed the core language and the core kind of heart of the database, you get to the point where if you remove enough of something, you may as well start from scratch because you don't really have anything to start build on top of.
Right.
And that's sort of the point that we got to. You know, we took a hard look at all the open source document databases that were out there, and we said, well, you know, can we extend this thing? Can we fork this? You know, or do we have to contribute back to the project? And is there one that delivers on all the things that we need to deliver on? And the simple answer was no, there wasn't. So we decided, okay, we needed to kind of build something. So then we sat down and had a look and asked ourselves the hard question of saying, okay, well, we know we need to build something. You know, is there stuff within the organization we can leverage? I mean, we're the biggest software company in the world. There has to be stuff that we can leverage from other teams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we started digging around and we started looking, and we worked with Microsoft Research and we worked with, you know, the other guys within our organization. We fall under the data platform group in Microsoft, and it's the same team that builds SQL Server and SQL Database in Azure. And these guys have been living and breathing data, you know, all their lives. So we sat out and we worked with them and we worked with Microsoft Research and we've used things in our service where we can. And we've only invented new stuff where we needed to invent new stuff. You know, we didn't just decide for the sake of it, it wasn't invented here, so we can do it better.
Right, right.
And off we're going to go and build it. We leveraged what we could. We helped other parts get better so that we could leverage them. We've taken some learnings from various teams. We've adopted them. We've changed them. And over kind of like this life cycle, we've got today what we have as a service.
Boys, that's a great story. Thank you. Now, how about actually, you know, when it came to hosting this in Azure, are we using other services that Azure has today, like our PaaS service or our IaaS service, or is there something special that you guys had to do?
So we run in the Azure data centers. We will be behind the same network kind of layer. We run on the same hardware. We use the same networking stack. All of that kind of stuff. We're an Azure service, right? So we run, eventually we will run wherever Azure is running, and, you know, the management experience is all the same. So there is a lot of things that we've had to use and reuse to fall within that Azure family. And there's some fundamental underlying technologies that we use, you know, on, in terms of how we run the service and how we do the management and operations and replicas and all of that kind of stuff. So there's some fundamental technologies that many Azure services build on top of. Those aren't publicly available services yet, but those are services that many of us kind of build on top of. When it comes to looking at things like, you know, where do we run compute and where do we have our storage and that kind of stuff, we took the decision to run solid state disks in the servers rather than backing with Azure storage, purely because of the fact that we needed incredibly low latency when we did writes and reads. And at the time there was, you know, there was just no way we could achieve the numbers that we'd set out to achieve by backing ourselves with Azure storage. So we took the decision to build on specialized hardware, so special disks and specialized disks. And that gave us the opportunity to actually, you know, do some clever work around the service itself to optimize for the hardware that we had. So you'll find that the service has actually been written and optimized for the conditions and stuff in which it runs in. But, you know, we run on the, like I said, the underlying foundations and the fabrics and all of that kind of stuff as other Azure services do.
So I hear you saying it's not using, so it's not using Blob Store, right? You're just using specialized VMs with SSDs, is that right?
Yep. So we're running on the VMs in the data center. So we have, you know, numerous kind of instances and numerous nodes that run, and these boxes have access to the actual SSD that's in the chassis of you know, the host machine. So yeah.
Does that still allow for, or is there a need for, the geo replication and those features like we have with Blob Storage now?
I mean, that is a good question, and yes, absolutely. You know, for building highly available services, and we want to be a highly available service. I mean, we are a highly available service. Since we've launched Preview, we've far exceeded our kind of goal in terms of service uptime. In order to do that and make sure that we never, ever, ever lose any customer data ever, I mean, that's like a mandate and a banner that, you know, should be written across, you know, the entrance of our offices in big, bold letters. But in order to make sure that we never, ever do that, you know, we need to make sure that we have internal replicas that we're keeping kind of consistent and we're keeping up to date and we're keeping in sync. And, you know, to allow you to build a highly available service on top of DocumentDB, you need to be able to kind of take into effect or contingency of what happens if we lost, you know, the San Francisco kind of Bay Area data center. How would you kind of fail over and restore to Europe? Or how would you be able to kind of distribute your writes, or I mean your reads, so that you can have localized reads in Asia when your writes are happening in your master, which is somewhere else, kind of thing. So in order to build those kinds of or allow you to build services that leverage that, we need to make sure that we have features later in the product that support some of that stuff. So still early days on our roadmap in terms of where we are as a service, but you can, it wouldn't be a long stretch to kind of expect things like backup and restore, geo-replication, that kind of stuff to come as a service. And because we built it from the ground up and because we built it to be this multi-tenanted, scaled-out, distributed system, we can now start leveraging those kinds of things like geo-rep and backup and restore and that kind of stuff, which otherwise might have been a bit difficult.
Cool.
Excellent. So, you know, Ryan, let's switch to put on a developer hat over here for a second. This all sounds great, and, you know, let's say I'm a developer. I was really excited to get my hands dirty with DocumentDB. I think they have to start off with the new portal, right, to get access to DocumentDB in its preview form. But beyond that, what are the general steps that a developer has to do to take full advantage of DocumentDB?
So, yeah, you're quite correct. In the new preview portal, you go in and you provision an account. And that basically sets you up with a billable account. It gives you some capacity allocation. And within that, you start creating databases and collections. And you can now, as of a couple of days ago, you can create databases and collections in the portal directly or you can actually, you know, create those databases and collections in your code itself. So we've got the management capabilities to provision a new database or provision a new collection or drop a collection or whatever you want to be able to do. So you would, the most important thing that you need is the endpoint URI and the master key, which you would get out of the portal. You would take those, you would go into your favorite IDE, whichever that might be, and, you know, if you're using Visual Studio, you'd go in, you'd open up NuGet Package Manager, you'd look for our package, you'd install the NuGet package, you'd use the key and the endpoint that you got out of the portal, and you could start writing code immediately, start inserting documents, start querying for documents, that kind of stuff. If you were a Node developer, you would go to npm and install our package. If you were a Python developer, you'd go to PyPI and install our package. And we'll have other SDKs like Java and PHP and those kinds of things coming later, where you'll be able to go into, you know, IntelliJ or Eclipse or whatever you want to do and go and find, you know, Maven's package repository or whatever the case may be. So that's how easy it is. We're going to be adding some more capabilities into Visual Studio, and you will see some of the stuff lighting up later in Visual Studio where you can add a connected service, and DocumentDB will be one of those connected services. So you'll be able to, from an existing application, just pull in a DocumentDB and we'll drop in and scaffold in, you know, a lot of kind of useful code that would just get you up and running pretty quickly.
Excellent. Yeah, one other question too then. So is there any sort of emulator or like an on-premise version of this, like with the Azure pack maybe, or is that something that exists or is even mentioned?
So we've been getting a number of requests for offline capabilities of the product, and I like to kind of break that one request up into two buckets. The one bucket is I'm a developer and I want to kind of write code while I'm sitting on the beach, because what else do developers do when they go to the beach, right? So they sit on the beach and they don't have internet access and they want to be able to code locally, or you set up your CI server and you want to run your integrated builds and do your tests and you need something offline to kind of test against, because you don't want to run your tests in the cloud and pay, you know, money to run your test environment. So that's the one kind of bucket. The other kind of bucket is I want to be able to have my own servers in my own data center somewhere. Or I want to run a VM in Amazon, and I want to be able to install DocumentDB as you would install SQL Server. So those are the two different kinds of buckets. One is run an actual production environment on your own, and the other one is kind of like this work offline and emulator simulator mode. Now to kind of answer the question of DocumentDB specifically and where it will fit into those two buckets, We're definitely working on a simulator and an emulator that'll be similar to, you know, Azure Table Storage's emulator or some other kinds of emulators that people are familiar with, where you'll be able to very easily on your laptop be able to emulate or simulate a DocumentDB environment. And that'll meet the needs of the people who want to dev offline and kind of run their tests. In terms of, is this going to be a installable product on Windows Server or via the Azure pack? The short answer is no. There is no immediate roadmap for that right now. However, you know, like with all things in the product, we take direction from the customers and from people that want to use it. So if that's something that people are passionate about and absolutely want to have and must have, the ability to run a cloud service on premises, then, you know, they can go to the feedback forum. There's someone's already asked for it. Go to the feedback, user feedback forum and go vote it up. And every time we kind of sit down in a planning session and we look at what features to add, that's one of the tools we use. So if enough people are asking for it and, you know, people are strongly saying that they absolutely have to have this, then it's something that we can't ignore.
Cool.
Excellent. That's a very good answer. Thank you, Ryan. Okay, I think that kind of I've exhausted all the kinds of questions I would have for Ryan. I mean, definitely myself have got a really good understanding on DocumentDB and totally hope our listeners did too. And if you're interested in this kind of technology, just go to the new portal and try it out. It's in preview form. What's the pricing? Is there pricing?
If you go to Azure.com and you look under documentation on the Azure.com site, under documentation, under data, there's a section for DocumentDB. There's a heap of documentation there about capabilities of the service, features of the service, some limitations and quotas in terms of what you get and what you pay for. Mm-hmm. There's some startup samples, there's tutorials, there's getting started videos. There's a whole heap of content on Azure.com.
Great, and we'll put links to all of that in the show notes. Kale, any questions for Ryan?
No, this has been awesome. Thank you for coming on, Ryan. This was really educational for me, so thanks.
No problem at all. It's only a pleasure, yeah.
All right. Thanks again, Ryan.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Take care. Bye.
See ya.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.